Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever and whenever you might be listening. My name is Frank Duncan, and you're listening to Backfield Banter. Thanks for joining us again today. Recap of our last episode, we had a chance to sit down with Riley Pint. He got to tell us about his story of professional baseball and how he got from St. Thomas Aquinas High School here in Kansas City all the way to the big leagues with the Colorado Rockies, and now he's playing the free agent game. Like I said, I'm Frank Duncan. I'm here with Zach McLeod, Daniel Harper, Bob Zimmerman, and our engineer behind the computer, Will Stevens. And today we've got a really special guest. He's been coming in to premiere for, I think, the last five-ish years on and off, right? And without further ado, I'll introduce Dakota Hudson from Dunlap, Tennessee. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So if we want to get started, you're the first person we've talked to that is not from Kansas City. Tell us how you got here, how you got to Premier, and kind of what your whole baseball story was coming up through the high school ranks in Tennessee, and obviously your professional career.
Yeah, I guess I'll start with how I got in here. Played with Ryan Sear, who was one of the first people in here with Premier.
Oh, geez, yeah.
I married his sister. He went to Mississippi State with me for like a year.
Hail State.
Yeah. Hail State. Go Dogs. But I married his sister and got over here and started working with Bob. And then it was, you know, about 6 months of me kind of just showing up until me and Bob really started hitting it off. And then I feel like every year I've been here, I got a little bit better. So just kept coming back.
Awesome. Awesome. So let's go back to the start of your career. And what age did you start playing baseball? And when did you kind of realize that baseball was in the cards for you in the long term?
Long term took a long time. I played ever since I can remember. My older brother and I, that was kind of always our thing. I guess my first year I can remember was probably 6 years old. I'm sitting back there with catcher's gear on and of the coach pitch league. So that was me. And then watching my brother play most of the game from the pitcher position or shortstop. So that was kind of mine and his thing. We kind of took off through high school. We moved around quite a bit. My dad was in the military. We started playing travel baseball at like 8. And so I'd spend summers in Knoxville, Tennessee, even though we would be stationed out in North Carolina. I'd spend summers at a good friend of mine, the Bird's house. They'd take care of me for summers at a time, and we'd just play baseball. My older brother played right down the street or stayed right down the street with his friend, the Ombies, and we'd go back and forth between tournaments. I did that all the way through high school. Wasn't very good until I hit puberty, which kind of late bloomers. I was the guy throwing 78 one year and 88 the next. And then that's kind of whenever I thought, hey, maybe I can do this in college. And then we took a year sabbatical from Sequatchie County High School. We moved to Pigeon Forge High School, started lifting weights, started in JUCO potential opportunities, and then kind of took it from there. Ended up at Mississippi State, though.
So growing up, I saw you shoot the basketball earlier before you're throwing your bullpen. So were you just baseball guy, or did you play other sports? Like, was the town you grew up in, was it big? Was it small? Like, what was all that about?
Yeah, Dunlap's is about, I guess it was about 5,000 people whenever I was coming through. It's a county school, so pretty small. I played every sport you can think of through the military, kind of moved around. We did hockey, soccer, basketball, football. Basketball is my favorite, though, until I started throwing a little bit harder. It's kind of became baseball. But yeah, we did a little bit of everything.
That's awesome. What position were you in? Basketball, were you pretty good?
I played shooting guard until I got a little bit later on, and then no one could really dribble, so I played point. Played point my senior year for like half a season, and then I had some injury stuff happen, and I had a chance of getting drafted, so I got that a little bit short and just focused on baseball.
Growing up, it sounds like you play a lot of different sports. Obviously, you took baseball more seriously. You're living with some of your friends, doing the travel ball circuit. Did you do any like training style stuff, or was that not really like an opportunity in your area? Was it pretty much just like play and get better and pitching games?
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot of facility work. We had, I guess growing up in the military, we did like a lesson here and there. My family really didn't have that much money going through the militaries. We were really blessed with the people and coaches we had for summer ball. And without those people, I don't think I would have ever had the instruction to know how to get better. So I was really blessed with the people I met along the way.
So you brought up the military a couple times, which is, I think, is pretty cool and kind of a unique background as far as sports go. And we talked a little bit about how the military and like the discipline that is involved with being in the military is very close parallel to sports. Did you ever have any experience with that growing up, like in a military family? Was there a certain level of discipline that you had to have? Was that kind of transferred over to your playing career?
Yeah, I mean, that was in my house early on. My dad would come home from PT and he would be seeing us off to school, and we'd be sitting there seeing him drenched in sweat doing his stretches like as he's done. So we always saw the discipline aspect of what it took to kind of be in the military. He was an Army Ranger himself, so that kind of started it. And then my dad would only talk about dropping your shoulders. Hey, you had a bad game, don't drop your shoulders, don't let them see. Like, so good or bad, sports became just something that was fun for me, and that I, as long as I wasn't doing that, I never had that bad car ride home, you know. So
yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think we've got really touched on the importance of body language, as far as I know most of us are pitchers in here, but the importance of body language. And that's something that I've heard from every single coach I've ever had, that if you let anybody know that you're kind of frustrated or upset or something, then it's just kind of like opening the door and letting people get under your skin and setting yourself up for a more failure by that point. So making sure that the body language stays good, stays positive, and you're always on to the next pitch, always into the next fight, is something that's really good. Bob, let's transfer over to you, because obviously Dakota's here because he works with you, and he's worked with you for, like you said, the last 5 years. I think when I first started coming in here, I believe there was a really cool article that was written by some national news outlet or something about the importance of Premier and Bob being in helping you in your career make that kind of jump, I think maybe to the big leagues. I'm not sure what it was. What was your first impression of Dakota? Like, when did he come in? And when were you like, damn, this kid's pretty good? He's got a really good future in this.
So I think he came in right after your first year being drafted. And I remember it was at the old facility. I think he came in and stood in the corner for a good 15 minutes before you did anything or said hello. One of the things we've talked about before is as a coach, kind of knowing how to stay out of the way when you need to stay out of the way. When people have good routines, like, let them get through their routine. And if they need help, give help. Don't just insert yourself and say, hey, let's go and do something right away. And so, I mean, that goes back to what Dakota said. It was probably, you know, five months before we really started like working on things together, because it was something that I wasn't just going to jump in and be like, hey, we need to do this or that. Here's what you do. You're successful at it. Keep doing it. How can we set them on top of that? And I think we did from a routine aspect right away. I'd say that was one of the biggest things for you, is a lot of the quote unquote advanced pitching training. I don't feel like you had experienced. And so we got you involved in a little bit of that. And I feel like that helped just maintain your body and keep you healthy at that point to be out there ready to go.
Yeah, I felt like the routine part of that was huge, because I was used to the 7-day routine, and jumping from that to 5 days, it's a difficult adjustment. And I felt like that helped me quicken the pace on getting through the minor leagues and getting the big leagues, for sure.
At Mississippi State, what was that like? Because obviously that's a really big school in the SEC. They're historic for being a good baseball program. I remember being at KU. We went down there to play in a tournament early in the year, but I remember going to the indoor, seeing the facility that they had. It's pretty unbelievable. So you're coming from a small town in Tennessee. You're getting to this big, big university. And like you said, you didn't really have the advanced pitching coaching going on. What was that like, stepping on a campus and being like, hey, now you're in the SEC, you're playing SEC baseball, playing against the best teams in the country. Either you're going to get with it or you're going to get left behind. What was that like?
It was very much what you're saying, get with it or get left behind. And if it wasn't for Butch Thompson, I mean, I had 2 years where I really struggled there. The Palmero Center, the people I worked with, like I said, my coaches really helped me piece things together. But got into a weightlifting program a little bit there with Brian Neal, who was great for me, and then able to move through. It was a shock, though. I mean, I got shelled for 2 years. I think I threw 30 innings total in my first 2 seasons before going my junior year. So it was a big learning adjustment for me.
Was there a mechanical adjustment and that kind of side to the pitching, or was a lot of it just physical? Because in our first episode, we had a chance to talk to Trevor and Zach. They're here in Premier running the strength and conditioning side. So we talked about the low-hanging fruit and the importance of what kids should be targeting as they're getting older from that kind of middle school, high school level. When you get to college, and I was the same way, I didn't touch a weight till I got to college. So I made an immediate jump without doing anything on the baseball field. What did you miss in high school as far as going from that physical maturity and what did they introduce at Mississippi State? What did you do differently that was like, hey, like I'm getting way better?
Yeah, the full meal plans, the weight room. I went from 175 pounds in this my first summer to 215 by the end of my freshman year. So I'm on about 40 pounds real quick.
Wow.
And I mean, I remember eating until I was
freshman 15.
Yeah, a lot of food there, though. That was the biggest thing for me. And then I gained velocity because of that. So I ticked up a lot my first 2 years. I went from averaging 90 to where I could sit 95. I was touching eights at times as a freshman in college. So I really saw the fruits of my labor from the weight room side. I really didn't know how to pitch. Still sporadic with my breaking stuff. Fastball command was in the zone, and I had about two or three innings where I'd see success. And before they started catching up with it, barrel speed kind of getting adjusted. And I had to learn how to pitch, and I ended up dropping my arm slot to where I could do that. And I think I did that going into the spring of my sophomore year because I got voted like worst of the pitching staff. They have the ranking system of Mississippi State. It's like, we got 24 guys, Dak, you're 23. And I'm like, well, is this coaches or players? And they're like, no, it's pretty much both. So that was kind of a funny, like, hey, what do I got to do to get on the field? You know, I'm sitting there with scholarship and trying to figure out what I'm going to do with my life. And baseball is what I love to do. Started trying to drop my arm slot, wound up being three quarters. And then I had a bullpen coach teach me how to throw a cutter. And then next thing you know, I'm, you know, don't really pitch that the whole rest of that year all that much. And then I go to Cape Cod League and have a great summer. And come back as well.
That was my second question was going to be, so wait, like we talk about the physical changes as far as lifting and stuff, but learning how to pitch, if you had a kid that came in today and you're like, hey, I really want to learn how to pitch, like for me, I would tell them you just have to keep doing it, right? I don't think there's any kind of secret that you can tell somebody that'll make them a better pitcher immediately. We can work on the mechanics stuff, we can work on that kind of stuff, but in terms of getting outs and going out to, like you said, Cape Cod, I would imagine the summers were probably where you made your biggest strides because you were getting the ball every X amount of days and you were just able to just go out and pitch and figure out how to get guys out.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about learning how to pitch. And I think I fell in the trap because I was over the top, I threw the basic sequences like, hey, here's two fastballs and here's a breaking ball to try and strike you out. I had to change my whole philosophy because I was what I thought a strikeout guy, and I had to kind of orient towards contact. I had Ron Polk come out to me my first summer game, and he's like, listen, we're not sending one down to the bullpen to warm up until you throw 85 pitches. So you're either going to finish it this inning or you're going to be out here for a long day. What helped me was seeing how hitters reacted to me and then start saying, oh, well, when I do this to this kind of swing for a hitter, then I can go to, say, the breaking ball, or these are kind of my reads. And I started making everything based on what I was actually experiencing or seeing from guys that I thought were similar to me.
And one thing that you talked about and Riley actually talked about previously, Riley was saying, like, I hadn't really experienced failure until I went to pro ball. And so, like, obviously you kind of felt that adversity before you got to pro ball. And I know a little bit about this just because when I went out to Colorado to watch you pitch this year, we were sitting down having breakfast and you were talking about that. So you can maybe talk about how, like, you didn't throw very much those 2 years. You could bet on yourself in the Cape Cod League and then come back and improve it all over again. So maybe talk about, like, where you were in a headspace, like what your thought process was. You said you were starting to, like, think about, like, do I need to go to another school? Like, what do I need to do?
Yeah.
So
I think that there was really one moment that sophomore year where I kind of had a moment. I guess if you play longer, you're like, oh, I was good this day. Finally had a day like that. And it was, I got a save against LSU and I had gotten out of a big situation. It's like, maybe I can do this. So leaving that year after having the scholarship taken, I really didn't put too much workload in my previous 2 years, but I was like, you know what? I'm just going to bet on it, see what I can do. And, you know, if I have a good summer here in the Cape, maybe I can go back. And my brother and I were out looking at colleges because at the time he was coming from Tennessee Tech and he went JUCO. And so we were going to go dual package. And then I had a good summer and he's sitting there looking at me. He's like, hey, you got to go back to Mississippi State. You have a great year at Mississippi State. You could potentially get drafted and actually pursue this. If you go to an NAIA and have the same year, you may not get that same offer. So it was a pretty tough time mentally, but it was all in. And I was out with Ben DeLuzio, a friend of mine who I played with at the Cape, and the Scalzi's were great to me. And I worked out there on the field. And by the way, best field that whole summer for Cape Cod League.
Yeah.
So I was just doing stuff to kind of keep myself distracted and playing ball and trying to enjoy what I thought was probably the last little bit of it.
Yeah. And some people listening may not know what the Cape Cod League is, but it's by far the number one summer league. I don't know what the percentage is. It's got to be like 95, 96% of guys that play in the Cape Cod get drafted and play professional baseball. I just did a quick Google search, like 32% of this past year's picks came from the Cape Cod League. And so it's the best of the best. You're going there and we can comp you up a little bit, but 56 innings, 143 ERA, punching out 40 guys. I mean, obviously you had a great summer. And so do you feel like part of that was backs against the wall, got to produce, got to figure out what's going on? Do you think part of it was just like Frank was saying, like, I'm getting the ball. I know I'm getting the ball every week, this day, throwing at this time. So where do you think that turning point kind of happened in that summer?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just kind of a progression because I get out there for my first outing. And like I said, that's Ron Polk saying, hey, you're going to do it. So like Frank saying, you're getting the ball. And I was like, okay, I'm going to take the ball. I'm not going to sit here and throw 100 pitches this inning or win one inning. I'm going to try and get as far as I can. So I was just under the same pretext of let me throw as many strikes as I can and let me at least see what they're going to do. If I can force them to swing at something I throw in the zone, then maybe I can force them to, you know, show me that I need to make an adjustment. So everything became a progression on me getting better, even though getting taken like 500 feet to right center by a lefty was not the best thing to feel. But hey, you hanging that breaking ball, that's one of the best things you can learn from if you look at it that way.
Yeah, people often understate the importance of pitching to contact and pitching in the zone. People get caught up so much right now in trying to get swing and misses, or trying to generate swing and misses, that they actually get away from pitching in the zone. And hitting is hard, right? Baseball is hard, but hitting especially is 3 out of 10 that you're a Hall of Famer, right? That means there's 7 outs.
You're getting handed.
Yeah. For me, just pitching in the zone, like more often than not, those should be outs. You know, you're going to have those one days where it's tough, but like, it's like you're going to get outs if you pitch in the zone. And then you start pitching in the zone and you realize, well, like I'm throwing fastball, sinker, whatever, right down the middle. And like now they're not even hitting it. They're swinging and missing at it. The confidence boost that gives you as a pitcher is huge. And then just the importance of learning how to pitch and kind of becoming comfortable going against these guys in the Cape Cod who are, it's not just the pitching side, it's the hitting side too. There's good hitters there every year. It's like, all right, my goal is to throw strikes and pitch in the zone. And I'm getting really good guys in college out at a high clip. Like I can do this. And then you can just take it like a rock rolling downhill. Now you got the momentum. Were you able to take that into college and your junior?
Like you're saying, that's exactly what I did. It was kind of that approach and that commitment of mentality that, you know, physically I'd been working out and learning as I was going, but I was able to mentally put that approach in. And then physically I continued to get more consistent from there. And by the time I showed up with Bob, we were able to focus on smaller details that actually ended up proving to give me more of a gap as far as what I was doing to get to the big leagues faster. And I felt like that's hard to find.
Riley talked about it, how he coming out of high school, he was so good in high school, and when he got to the pro level, it was a little bit more difficult for him to find that traction. But he also had some guys in his ear trying to get him to do stuff outside of his comfortability. With the coaching, when you got to Mississippi State, how did they approach coaching their pitchers and talking about how, like, if there was something that they thought you could do better, was it more of like you approached them, or was it like they were immediately hands-on wanting to change you?
No, whenever I first showed up, Butch Thompson was very much into run your own show. FIO was Cohen's thing, figure it out. They put in a basic plan and they let you make detailed changes based on what you thought, and you call your own pitches and you ran your own game. And that was the responsibility you had to help you get better. And my time with Butch Thompson, like I may have been the worst pitcher he ever had for those 2 years, at least far as like nightmares go, because I was picking his brain or whatever. But he went to Auburn. And then Wes Johnson shows up, who was great with the physical side. So then I started pitching like Butch was talking to me about. And then I started, you know, physically putting it together. And then I'd have Wes Johnson in the middle of the clubhouse going, hey, what are you having for dinner after this? Like mid-game, I'm like, dude, it's the 7th inning. You know, it just becomes something we did. And it was just like a trust thing. So it was all a building process. You know, it was pretty fun.
Pulled up some numbers here. Like took that momentum and threw 113 innings. Had a 2.55 ERA. You end up being a first-round pick. So we started working together on the strength side last year, and you're a very detail-oriented guy. You handed me this notebook of, hey, these are the lifts I did. This is the stuff I did. I had notes on like what you ate that day, how much water you drank, the lifts you did leading up to your outing, how your outing went. What got you into that routine? I played with a guy that kept a hitting journal and where he had an awesome sophomore year and his numbers declined a little bit as a junior, but he knew like I was swinging at the same pitches. I was hitting the balls just as hard as I was the year before. I was just a little unlucky. So he didn't really change what he did from year to year because he always had that to recall. Why did you start doing that? How do you feel like it helped you?
Yeah, I started doing that. I think mostly because it was an accountability thing. I didn't want to look over at anyone else other than myself and say, oh, this is why I was good or bad. You know, and as far as quality went, I wanted to be as strong as I could. I wanted to feel as good as I could. It was just knowing where I was at, you know, or whatever was going on. And that way, if I had something down the road where I needed to make an adjustment, I could look and see what I did because I knew, you know, college was college, but I was hoping to play longer than that. I wanted to know like what my body needed for whatever was going on. And so that's kind of where I took that, and just jot down notes.
Yeah, you even have a recovery on there. Like I did this for recovery today. I ate this. I drank this much water. And I remember looking at that and I was like, wow, it's really cool. It was helpful for me, just like a roadmap of like, all right, these are the lifts he did when he felt super successful. And I think your first couple years of pro ball were also in there.
I mean, that's an unbelievable amount of attention to detail. We've talked about the process and the routine. We haven't talked about the importance of the journaling side of that. Because I think that in anything that we do, the aim of our craft, right, in pitching is to become more consistent. Right? If you have something that kind of holds you accountable and allows you to go back and see what you did that day. And I don't mean this to become like an obsession where like, oh, I'm not going to be able to do this if I don't do this. You know, like I don't want it to be a crutch, but it is important to know what got you into that space that day where something was like, okay, I threw a no hitter or whatever. What did I do? Like you don't need to go back and eat the exact same thing, but there are some, yeah, I mean, I probably would, but there are certain things that helps you prepare for that game, those things that you did that week. And I think if you were able to do that long enough and you look back at it, you'll be able to see a pattern in the things that were important and the things that did help you start to turn that page to get to that next level. Do you have anything that you kind of remember distinctly in your routine that you kind of realized that was becoming a pattern and something that helped you take that little next step?
Yeah, I think the big thing when I went from college to pro ball is that whenever me and Bob were talking, especially, and maybe he can speak on this, is I had a lot in there in that 7-day span. So we cut back. And I think the one thing that we took away was, hey, I'm going to do my Jaeger bands. And after that, I'm going to do whatever I need to do to feel as limber as possible. And that's going to get me ready to play. And then we threw some other stuff in there, but that's based on me trusting someone who I really knew what they were talking about. And of course, me and Daniel, we've had a lot of conversations in here that have helped me progress throughout my career. So I think that's an important part of it.
I guess kind of looking at that routine that you had in college, is there anything you still do today that would be in that notebook from your sophomore year?
Yeah, still, I'm still hitting the bands. I'm still getting on the hip. I think that's where it's cut back to. You know, you get a little bit older as you go. So
you talk about the kind of the transition from college to professional. Walk us through, you had a great senior year. You start getting kind of realize that you're on this draft radar. What was that kind of like? I know for me, like there was a lot of scouts coming to do like those interviews. One organization likes to measure your ankles and like do some crazy like that. What was that like for you when these teams started coming to talk to you? What kind of questions were they asking you? What stood out to you in that process? And then talk about like getting drafted and what that meant to you and where you were, what round, like all this stuff that happened and what organization ended up taking it.
Yeah. Let me see. Where do I even begin? Mississippi State, like, we're going through everything. Pittsburgh had the one questionnaire that stood out to me the most. And that's because they were checking the upper trap area for hair to see if I had a high level of testosterone.
So that, Pirates, baby.
They
do things differently.
Yeah.
They do things differently. There's no doubt.
They were naming off all these guys that were like Hall of Fame, you know, players were like, oh, these guys were really good. They had this patch of hair. You know, that was the funniest thing that happened with that. The progression through the season, Wes Johnson and John Cohen handled it like, very professionally. It was all the way until it was only whenever I had breaks. It was only whenever I wasn't in class. It was always student first, baseball second. And so they handled and scheduled everything. It was like, hey, show up here, do this. And so as much as I had going on, it was very lax. I didn't do any social media when that was going on. I just tried to keep my head down and focus. They were doing a TV series with the school. It was called Relentless at the time. So there was a lot going on. As far as the draft goes, I didn't know when I was going. I had Bo McInnes as my representative at the time. He still is. He's a great guy. But the draft was going on. He was like, hey, well, the Rockies called you. Maybe they'll take you at pick 4, which was Riley. And they were like, if Riley's not on the board, maybe we'll take you. And then I was like, I don't know when I'm going to go, but get as much money as you can. Hopefully that means I'll get a lot longer of an opportunity. So I'm sitting there and I got surrounded by my family and Wes Johnson, my pitching coach. And I'm sitting there day before the Super Regionals, you know, having a couple beers, just sitting there. And it's like, are you sure you're going to be able to pitch tomorrow? Because, you know, you play in Arizona and ended up having a good game there, even though we lost. Bobby Dalbec had probably the best weekend series I've ever seen from a college human. But that's how we got put out. But I'm sitting there with Ashlyn, who we were dating at the time, and I was just sweating. Just sitting there shaking, didn't know when it was going to be. I knew it was going to happen, hopefully, at some point. And the Cardinals ended up selecting me a 34th supplemental pick, a 34th pick in the first round. I think I was the last one. I was the third pick the Cardinals had that year in the first round. And that was an opportunity to get to my dream. Everybody has that. It's like, oh, I want to pitch the big leagues. I want to be able to do that. And that's always what I thought. No, it was just a great experience.
So you go on, you pitch in the Super Regional. Did you guys win the Super Regional?
No, we lost.
Okay.
We lost.
So you lose the Super Regional, and then what was the next step? Like, the Cardinals took you, like, how quickly were you on a plane heading to Bonwood season, or what was that like?
Yeah, I went to Jupiter, Florida the next week, sat there and didn't pitch for a month. They let my arm rest because the inning workload was a lot. And then I built up as a reliever. I did 4 weeks where I was doing one inning of games every week. And then I moved up to high A, jumping the fence, or the walk-up land, is what they called it. I jumped the fence, went to high A, and I did, if I threw one inning, I got 1 day off. And if I threw two innings, I got 2 days off.
This was all the same year you got drafted.
Same draft year.
That's pretty impressive. That doesn't happen too often.
And then double A, I was going to the postseason, and they called me up as a reliever to throw in the postseason. I only threw I threw two innings.
That's pretty cool.
I got a save, though. It was sick.
That's cool.
And then I met a lot of the guys that I ended up playing with to start that.
That's in Springfield.
Yeah.
Nice.
So I started, I started the next following season there as a starter. I got shelled for about a month and a half and then figured some stuff out. Ended up having a good second half of the first half. And then I got to AAA at the end of that year. And then I started in AAA and kind of the same thing with the big leagues as a reliever.
That's cool. What was kind of your favorite stop along the way in the minor leagues with the Cardinals?
Well, Springfield was great, dude. They had Galey's right there, and it was a nice breakfast place. Quality biscuit and gravy, which is a must for me. And then they had
those Midwesterners know how to make some biscuits and gravy.
And then Black Sheep.
First spot. What is his money?
If you're ever through that area, you definitely got to stop in and check it out.
So what was your welcome to professional baseball?
I think my big thing was I was the guy that had to get people coffee. I didn't even drink coffee, but it was like, hey.
Are you talking about the big leagues, or are you talking about
that's
just Pro Bowl?
All the way up through. Because I feel like
really?
everywhere I got it was like, hey, we time card, man. Like, you're young. Like, I'm going to be closing here in a minute. Go get me a coffee. It was guys that were just screwing me. They took me under their wings and stuff, but it was just really funny. Like, I must have been the coffee guy for, like, at least a full season, 2 seasons worth. I was the coffee guy all the way up until my third year of service as a starter with St. Louis, because I was the youngest guy. You know? So it's like, hey, what if you guys need, you know, here I am. And then I had Flaherty, who I'd played with, and he's younger than me. So that was a funny dynamic between me and him. But yeah, I had a lot of good guys. They took me under their wing, though. I learned a lot. They let me annoy the crap out of them. So.
Well, I've kind of had the same thing happen throughout my career. I just ask a lot of questions, you know. If there's somebody that's probably going to know more than me, I'll sit next to them and I'll just try and pick their ear. So I think that's important as part of the learning process, and it helps you kind of like learn stuff quicker. Obviously, being with the Cardinals, you said you were one of the younger guys when you got up to the big leagues. The guy that jumps out to me, Adam Wainwright. You know, the Cardinals are a very legendary organization in my eyes. Going back to my youth with like Mark McGwire, Albert Pujols, seeing all those guys come through. But you got the chance to be in the rotation with Adam Wainwright, who is, I would imagine, a first ballot Hall of Famer. What kind of questions were you bouncing off him? Did he get annoyed with you? And what was his coffee order?
It took me about 2 years before I said anything to Wainwright, at least as far as like really annoying him. And that was because in spring training, I would stand right behind him and Miles Michaelis would be sitting there talking, and Flaherty would kind of chime in, and I had Austin Gomber. All those guys were all like in this little area, so they'd sit up on the chairs. I would just stand right there behind them. So if you ever see like that one guy that's just in the background, that was me. Wayno. You know, drinks it black. I think he just like asked me for a coffee and then throw it away. And then my best story with him is my first spring training. I'd known him for like a week. I'm sitting there like got that nervous kind of deal with me. And he's like, hey, do you have anyone to play catch with? I'm like, oh, geez. Hit him in the chest. So my first couple of throws, I was throwing a regular two-seam at a time. It would cut. And he goes, mine does that too. And he throws me this one back and it like cuts probably like 3 feet across, and it's just a sinker grip. He goes, try this. And he shows me the one seam I ended up throwing. And I've been throwing that. That's been my best pitch of my career. And you know what's nice of him? He only offered to take 5% of every outing. So that's been my best story with him. But he is everything he was cracked up to be, and a great teammate.
Is there anybody else that kind of jumps out in your mind as far as your teammates and those gens that you get along the way?
Yeah, I mean, I played with Pujols his first time back in St. Louis. After being gone for so long, I was actually the guy he hit his first homer off of. There's a lot.
No big deal.
Yeah, no big deal. So then the next spring training, or I guess in 22, he comes in and he's like, oh, yeah, I remember your sinker. I go, yeah, it must have felt pretty light. I'm pretty sure you hit the upper deck.
Thanks, Bobby.
He was fun to play with. I played with Yachty. Those guys, they just spewed knowledge and put in a wealth of knowledge out for everyone who was willing to listen. And I think that says a lot for why their teams that they were on were so good always. They brought guys up to a level that I don't see very often.
Yeah.
So you got to have Yachty and Molina behind the plate. How is having such a veteran back there bring confidence to you on the mound? Just when was the first time you shook him off, if you ever did, and what happened on that pitch?
Great question.
It took me like halfway through my full rookie season as a starter to shake off. And I think the first time I accidentally did it when I came up as a reliever, and it was a cross-up. And that was the most terrifying moment of my life. I'm sitting there at Dodger Stadium. We're up by one run. It's a 3-2 ball game. He calls a sinker in. I throw a curveball. First curveball of the season. It's like chasing 2+1 minus outs. I just remember being so sped up, and he walks out to me after the ball. Literally, I think it just went to the backstop, and it was like, I think it was like the worst called ball of the year because it was like right down the middle, but he dives in, and I've never been so scared. I was like, I'm going to try to lay. I'm going down. This is it. And I'm sitting there on a good run, but he was great, man.
What did he say to you when he came out there?
He was like, don't ever do that again. I said, and he goes, outs plus two. He dumbed it down for me. So I think that was honestly like one of my heart was beating so fast that first year out of the bullpen.
Thank God for PitchCon, right?
Yeah. It simplifies a lot. You know, that presence, though, your first couple times out there in a big league stadium are different.
You've obviously, like, just backing up with what Daniel was asking. So you've gotten to throw to a few different catchers now. What made him stand out? If there was anything, you know, because obviously, like, as a fan watching, he is one of the best, if not the best.
Yeah.
Right. So, like, what made him different in terms of working with him every day? And, like,
to me, there was a few things that stood out. Like, you're talking about how they make you better. He'd get me to pitch a certain way so that whatever the bullpen was going to do was more opened up later in the game. So he would pitch to your strengths and have that going on. But he would also be like, hey, remember 2 months ago when you threw so-and-so that backdoor curveball and you punched him out with guys in scoring position? We're not going to try that with no one on. We're going to give him the fastball, and maybe we let him swing at that and try and get a ground ball with no one on, and then try to stay away from damage. And then maybe we use that later if we get into a situation. So it was not a savior stuff but he knew very much that if you were a starter, it was a complete game. He saw a complete game, and he used your strengths to what you did best. And I felt like I could throw, he was calling fastballs after I'd pipe one down the middle. Guys took G-hacks on him. I'd throw another one right down the middle. I'm like, he knows what's going on. I'm just going to throw this right over the plate. And it just felt like I was ahead based on what he was calling. And he pick his brain as much as you wanted. So I'd be like, hey, why did you want to go curveball or whatever? So sequencing and that kind of stuff. But just the way he thought, like his thought process was crazy.
Well, it sounds like his memory, too. It's pretty crazy.
And I played with some gold glove catchers. I had Matt Wieters for a little while, and I played with Jake Stallings last year.
I played with Stallings, too.
Those guys are very, very smart, but it was just like his complete package. Those all those guys make a pitching staff.
Yeah, I do want to go back to what you just said about understanding how a starter impacts the game for the relievers. I doubt anybody listening today, if you're out there in your high school and stuff, we don't need to worry about this. Like, this is down the line, but that is such a high level of thinking and a high level of attacking a lineup. So from what I've always learned is that if the starter does his job making hitters uncomfortable by pitching in, that's going to open up a way. And when you get these guys in the coming out of the bullpen that are just these donkeys that are throwing 100 with wipeout sliders, it's going to make their life that much easier. Right? There's obviously a certain amount, but if you just kind of just let the hitters kind of enjoy their time, yeah, you know, it's going to make their life harder. And like, it's something that's completely overlooked for many, many levels. But when you get to that big league level, like you said, like this is one of the best of the best. Like that's an unbelievable thought process that goes through it that people should be aware of.
You see it every year. Teams that limit their bullpen's exposures where the starters can command the game, eat up innings, control the plate. Those are the teams you see in the playoffs.
Yeah.
Like when you have three guys pitching 200 innings, those teams usually are way more successful because now their bullpen's not overexposed.
Right.
Now their stuff is more electric, a slider that gets thrown away, you know, and still is middle away, doesn't get hit because they aren't cheating there as much. So now all of a sudden these like one little instances of pitches that might get caught and beat you are succeeding more often than not.
I do have a question. You were talking about Wainwright showing you your one seam and you've started using that. That's been your best pitch. And so we've talked a lot about how do you know when you're getting good advice? How do you know when you're getting bad advice? All that kind of stuff from coaching. And we were talking the other day in the facility where you said you feel like some of your best pitching advice comes from hitters. And I believe that as well. I just had Frank watching Caleb hit the other day. We were doing a sinker slider guy. And I was like, hey, Frank, you throw a sinker slider. So this is how we would attack you. Is that right? And he's just kind of talking his way through. When I see right-handed hitter, this is what I'm trying to do, and this is why, and this is how you would counter that. We're just bouncing ideas off each other. So maybe you can kind of talk about why you think that the hitters are giving you good advice and why maybe not always talking to pitchers is always the best way to get pitching advice. Same with hitting. I think hitters should talk to pitchers because that's who they're going against.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at a big league roster and you look at the pitching staff, there's a lot of unique, you know, approaches to pitching. I think being unique helps out a lot. And I think that if you talk to hitters, you get perspective. And I think that that perspective makes you to where you can still stick with whatever you're good at, but you can use it differently or mold it in a way that may open up your game. Like, I'll use Goldschmidt for an example, but that guy is one of the smartest hitters I've ever talked to. And he would say, hey, if you can use two fastballs, it's just hard to picture both of them at the same time. So he may be able to get to the sinker in, but maybe that four seam away. I'm not saying he's not going to hit the four seam.
Yeah.
Because that guy's great. I'm just, maybe it gets you off a little bit. And at the big league level, it's a game of inches. So it changes your perspective and allows you to get better quicker.
I want to go back to what you talked about earlier in the podcast where we were talking about reading hitters. Talked about having Yachty back there too. Yachty, I would imagine, takes some of the pressure off you to read hitters, and I would imagine he's reading everything at every second of the game. For the people listening, and now this is going to go back to we're kind of keeping it simple for the high schoolers, what's one of the first thing that you see from a hitter that you kind of register, like, okay, I see that he reacted this way, now I'm going to be able to do this? What's something that you look for?
The big thing for me is their timing. If they're fouling something off and they're barely underneath it and it goes straight back, they're all over that pitch. So it's just from there, you just got to navigate, you know, change timing. It's speed change. And I think everyone that I've seen that pitches for a long time is great at either deception or speed change or both.
At the end of the day, yeah, that's all it is. All pitching is just keeping them off balance. What do we talk about? Pitching to contact, generating weak contact. If we do that more often than not, we should be successful. I had a pitching coach in short season A ball when I first got drafted. He said that. And this is when we were charting. I don't know if you ever had to chart the stands. But Pirates, we had to sit in stands in long pants in the middle of the Florida summer charting. And we were sweating our balls off. But we would be sitting in the stands and my pitching coach said, okay, we talk about reading hitters. One of the first things you have to understand is where does the hitter want the pitch, right? And he said the first thing that I always look for was when that hitter would be on deck, watching his on-deck swings and seeing where that bat path is and what he's imagining himself hitting. And so when I started doing that, I'm like, okay, that seems pretty simple, but why hasn't anybody ever told me that before? So I'm sitting in the stance charting and looking at the on-deck hitter, and I'm like, oh, he's kind of like Scooby. It looks like he's trying to like really pull his hands and stay inside out. And then you get into the game, you start facing hitter, and you're like, whoa, like that's exactly what he's trying to do. There is a certain amount of, okay, like he's trying to visualize this on deck so he can do this in the games. That helped me understand how I needed to attack that hitter. Has that ever happened with you?
I've heard that before, but you said keep it simple. That is some advanced stuff right there, I think. I mean, as far as looking over and being present in the game to not only be where you're at, but be able to
go the series.
Yeah.
Using the game too.
Okay.
I do have an example of this. Last year, we were throwing live. Dakota's throwing. We have our pro guys hitting. We had a couple high school kids jump in there, and Dakota struck a kid out with a couple sliders in a row. So he's off to the side, practicing like he's going to hit an away slider. And so he just goes two-seam in, jams, and breaks his bat. And this is a great learning experience. He comes over, he goes, hey, when you're doing that, you're telling me what you want to do. Do not do that. And it was great because he was stepping out after the pitch. And those are little things that you're talking about. It's like a game of inches in the big leagues. If they're going to give you a little bit of what they want to try to do, and you've got all the analytics, you got all that stuff. But when you're reading somebody and you realize, oh, this is what they're trying to do to me, and you just showed me your hand, now I can expose that. And so as you get older and the more reps you have, if you're 16, do not use that advice. Just focus on throwing strikes, staying in the game, getting outs. But as you get older, you know, you're just trying to cut those corners like just a little bit at a time. And if somebody gives you that, you're obviously going to take advantage of it.
Yeah. I mean, if you master your physical at a young age and then you're able to then turn into the mental side, I think it gives you like a little bit of the best of both worlds. Because as you get older, like you still want to maintain that physical side, but like you got to have the mental edge to keep yourself in it. And everyone's throwing 100 nowadays coming straight from college. And, you know, talent is just at an all-time high. So it's a game of inches. That's to keep your job.
Yeah, I think you're looking for any kind of window of opportunity and those kind of aspects. Because when you get to a certain point, everybody's great. But if you can have that one little sliver of edge, whether it's like the Astros with the buzzer on the pitcher, right? If I know what the hitter is trying to do, I know what I can do away from that. Obviously, I'm going to still pitch my strengths, but I know at the end of the day, like where that kind of blind spot is for the hitter.
So going back to your minor league career, you know, having pitched in the SEC, everybody always says, you know, SEC baseball is equal to double A baseball or high A baseball. Kind of just depends on the year. In your opinion, like, is that true? Because let me go in Kentucky, I've played in double A now. I think double A is 10 times better than SEC baseball.
Right now, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's better than SEC baseball, but I think the top end of SEC baseball could compete with some double A teams, but I think the talent in double A right now is. It would blow it out of the water, especially when I was there. You know, speaking from my time versus now, it was about a game played like high A, I felt like, whenever I was coming through, but it was just a clean game. The talent, though, after high A and after, I mean, rookie ball, you see guys throwing 100 to the backstop.
Yeah.
You're not seeing that 100-mile-an-hour arm in the SEC unless they're throwing strikes. So it's kind of like there's give and take in both aspects, I think.
I know there's a lot to people talk about, the kind of different jumps that happen from college to pro ball to the big leagues. The one I've always heard is that the biggest jumps you see are from high A to double A, and then from triple A to the big leagues. Is that pretty accurate?
I think it's pretty accurate. I think in triple A, you have a lot of guys who are smart, but it's getting better, right? So it's like the talent's getting better and they're also getting smarter. So a game is just changing a little.
Yeah.
It's really fast, but there's benchmarks and quality of hitters as you go up. Like maybe they're better or worse against spin. You see a lot more of those kind of guys, and then you dominate just the average hitter to move on.
And I remember you're talking about like, hey, in rookie ball, like, I could bury a really good slider and a guy will take a swing at that. And then when you got to double A, you're like, not a
rookie ball, you could throw a bounce a 40-foot breaking ball if it looked sharp down out of the hand, and they're swinging. But they're all over heaters, though. That's the place where big league pitchers go to throw fastballs and get hammered.
Absolutely.
They get hammered.
Too many strikes.
It's great. They're out there working on stuff. But in high A, I felt like it was guys were starting to shrink the zone a little bit, could see the difference between spin, and then they were pushing out over for fastballs and they'd cover the away, and then like mistake up and then heater is where they do the damage. You have to pitch in a double A. You have to be able to move your fastball around and dump in off speed. And I think that they just shrink the zone the further you go up. And now with the automated zones, they're really shrinking the zone in triple A. I mean, you got to throw that thing like right out there for it to be a strike.
We've always kind of looked at the lineups, the 1 through 9. You know, when you're in the big leagues, 1 through 9, those guys are all big leaguers, right? There's a reason they're there. They has unbelievable success through the minor leagues, and that's why they're in the big leagues. Triple A, depending on the organization, will have like maybe what, 1 through 6, maybe 1 through 7, those guys that are all kind of like those fringe big leaguers that, depending on the year they're having, they're going to be there. Double A, there's going to be 1 through 4, 1 through 5, but those hitters that are going to be at the next level, going to continue to move up. And then high A, you have maybe those 1 through 3, but same at the college, you know, depending on the college you go to, depending on the conference, you're probably going to have 2 or 3 hitters in the lineup that are going to be able to beat you on any given night. But then the rest of the guys, if you want to be a professional, those are the guys you have to get out on a nightly basis.
In my opinion, it's like, obviously the outside looking in, I'm the only guy at this table that has not played professionally, but I always talk to the hitters who have professional hitting starts in double A, high A, low A rookie ball. It's guys with tools, guys with potential, and they're kind of climbing their way up. Then you get to double A and they start putting together these professional at bats. I know what I can and can't do. I know what this guy's trying to do, and I know how I can have success against it. And then just looking at like AAA, it just gets more polished and you get to the big leagues. And then obviously it's all the talent and they're polished with what they want to do. They know what you're trying to do. Maybe they've seen you 4, 5, 6, 20 times. And so is that how you see it as a pitcher?
Last time I was in AAA, it felt like everyone basically in the lineup for at least a couple weeks of their season could have been a big leaguer, but it's the consistency of how they do it that makes them a big leaguer. I think there's enough talent there for a lot more guys playing professional baseball, but it's just about who can make their bad day not so bad, because everyone has good days and everyone has bad days. But those peaks and valleys, they change so drastically. If you're taking 4 punch outs versus getting, you know, hitting the sack fly or moving the runner over or getting that butt down or whatever it is to shrink those at bats, maybe you get an extra walk a day over the course of a season per game.
When I talk to the hitters, like, if you've been drafted, your ceiling is good enough. We know that. It's why you got picked. It's why you got signed. It's why you have a contract. It's really that floor. When you're having a bad day, something my college coach used to say, how good can you be on a bad day? Like, good pitchers get outs on a day they feel bad. You see Verlander or Scherzer, all these guys that are awesome. Yeah, they're way better than everybody else on their good day. But you know what else they are? They're really good on their bad day. It's the same thing when you see hitters. You know, Bobby Witt Jr. this year, really good on a bad day. He's going to work a walk. He's going to hit a ball hard, make a play in the field. It's not 4 punchies, an error, and then we'll see you later.
Yeah. Still waiting on some of that check to be sent my way. I got it going.
I do want to switch gears a little bit here. I think that you're the perfect guy to talk to about this, because as coaches here at Premier, we have to work with the high schoolers, and the day and age we live in is just technology is king. You came up where you said you never had the high level pitching instruction until you got to college. How was learning how to pitch without technology?
Yeah, a lot of it for me was coming up, at least it was all reads on hitters. So if it didn't work against the hitter, I wasn't going to use it. So that was a little bit harder for me to introduce new things, like, oh, I'm throwing a new curveball, let me dump it in. But I think technology gives you more confidence to introduce a full game plan earlier. But right now I'm using it as kind of a benchmark. Like, I want to get to things, I want to see where I'm at consistently, and then I want to be able to try and stay there and move my stuff around and command it from there. And if I'm able to be the same guy every time with the same movement, I'm going to command the ball much better. So it's kind of like it's a tool to make me more consistent for now. I don't know if I would have used it in college. I mean, I still don't understand it. That's Bob's. Bob, like, hey, Bob, is that okay? Hey, does that look all right? But I think you guys all are better with technology than I am. But I think for me, changing over, if they hit it on the ground, that was like, okay for me, whether that's a low bar or not.
No, I agree with you 100%. I think we all came from a place where technology wasn't used when we were developing as youth players, but it is something that we cannot avoid now. Yeah. And if we're not using it with our youth players, we're not doing our jobs right. You have a high schooler come to you, like, he wants to talk about his pitch metrics. What do you say to him?
Well, did they take the last one you hit? are they hitting the ball off of you very hard all the time? You know, if they're doing that, then yeah, you need to take a dive and look into it. If you're getting outs and you need to use it to figure out what you're doing right, and then it's about using it as a consistency piece. I think if you're getting outs, I think that's the end all be all. At the end of the day, I may have the worst stuff in the big leagues, but if I'm getting consistent outs, that's where the jobs are.
Kat, I want to like elaborate just one thing on that, because I'll use your season last year, and I know, yeah, I know it's not what we wanted, but you talk about these guys that are getting so caught up in like, oh, my pitch metrics got to be this, or I got to do this, where they're not focusing on how they're going to functionally apply that into the game. Like last year, you were working through a bone spur. We know that, yeah, we were having to change some things we were doing. You were moving differently. Your pitches were different. If we look at your sinker just like in a microscope without any of your other pitches or what you do last year, like the numbers got advanced. The movement shape got bigger. We were getting negative depth. We were killing all the vertical, going negative on it. We were expanding the horizontal. So as an individual piece, it looked like, man, that's becoming a better pitch. But it was obviously getting seen earlier. We weren't creating the bad contact as good and consistently. But for those guys that are getting so caught up, like, oh, I need my four seam to have 20 inches vert, or I need my, you know, get under zero on this changeup. It's like, well, hold on, is that functionally playing? And so even though this pitch, because we're having to do the workarounds of the bone spur and so your arm is moving differently, your pitch is actually getting worse. And so I think that's important for a lot of high school kids, college kids to understand that just because something shows inside in the facility that, oh yeah, that looks cooler on TrackMan, it's not necessarily a functional pitch, or it's not functionally getting you better.
Last year, I had the curveball that I started throwing and the sinker. I could get it to move 20 inches each way. But those pitches, if I left them over the plate, were getting shelled. And it was like, okay, well, you know, I need it to break shorter and later. And yeah, so that they see the same ball. Yeah. And that's kind of where the conversations we had, where it was kind of like, how do we piece this together? And yeah, I mean, bone spurs, whatever. That's the goal for this offseason, right?
So yeah. We talked a little bit about like adversity and stuff like that. So like you're playing professional baseball, there's highs and lows. How do you manage that, especially with social media? I think that's a lot different, like Frank's talked about. We just didn't deal with that as much. What would your advice be? And how can you manage those highs and lows? Because that's more of a microscope now than ever. You've pitched in playoff games. There's a lot of eyes on you. How do you kind of shut that out and try to just focus on what you're doing?
Yeah, I think there's two things that I've heard. One is something I've heard. One is more of the thought process I've had, which may not as well be good advice, but the first one's from what I heard, and that's you're never as good as you think you are, and you're never as bad as you think you are. So it kind of keeps you neutral as baseball being a game, and it's part of being in that progression of consistency, right? Highs and lows mentally will be highs and lows physically. And then the other part is most of the people that are willing to go out there and truly bash you have never done it. And that's fine. That's fine. There's a reason that there are people to be in they're paying for the seats and to get in the stands. That's great. We want everyone to be there. Yell at me as much as you want when you're there. That's perfect. I love it. It's what baseball's for. That's, yeah. You know, so highs and lows, enjoy where you're at, I think. And just know that most of the people that are yelling at you are either a big fan of the other team or they just haven't experienced what you're experiencing. And that's fine. It's perspective, I think, in both aspects.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think talking about dealing with adversity, I've always been told that like the most important thing is the next pitch. You know, from a pitching standpoint, that's something that if you can hold on to that very well and kind of remember that every time, no matter what happened and how good your outing was or bad your outing was, like if you just focus on the next pitch, making sure that next pitch is as good as you can make it, then the rest will take care of itself. Did I hear you say you had your scholarship taken away?
Yeah,
in college?
Yeah.
To me, talking about dealing with adversity, like you talking about how important those years are in your career, you dealing with that then, I would imagine, has set you up very well. Because like you said, you had to cut it on yourself. Now you became a free agent. You just signed with the Angels. The rest of your career now is just gonna be betting on yourself. How did that prepare you for now what you're going through in your professional career? Because pitching in Denver is not easy. Obviously, this year was tough with an injury. Yeah, but now you flush it. The only thing that matters is this next year.
I mean, health-wise, big deal. Big deal. Adversity, though, like going through that in college, I wouldn't trade my college experience for anything. All the good, all the bad. I mean, I'll say that 2 years of really being put through the test mentally and a couple good conversations with my coaches really led me to the thought process that kept me in that positive I can do it mindset and also seeing a little bit of result. If you can get one guy out, it's just about consistently doing it. So that's where I took it. Ownership and all that led me toward that. But going in through the minor leagues and then having this situation now, it's like, you know what? It's right back to it. If I didn't think I could still do it, even with the bone spurs last year, I had glimpses of great games. And if I didn't think I could physically do it, I would have already hung it up. But they're still fighting me. I don't think I'm done. So that's kind of where my mind's at. So
hell yeah.
You know, we'll see what we can make.
No, I hear you 100%.
I think that's important because most people want that track. I call it the LeBron James track. Number one player in the world in high school, goes number one overall in draft, changes a franchise around, won multiple championships. Most people don't have that track when you become a big leaguer or in the NBA, NFL. At some point, you're going to have some kind of adversity. I think it serves you well whenever you're younger before you get to that point, because if it happens when you get to the big leagues and you've never had to deal with it before, I think it becomes that much harder because, number one, you're facing the best competition in the entire world. And number two, like, there's just more people watching you and you're trying to figure out something that you've never had to figure out before.
Yeah. Plus, once you're in pro ball, you're kind of on an island, too. I mean, everybody's trying to take your job. They're always looking for your replacement. So if you never experience failure and don't know how to deal with it, that can be paralyzing. You can absolutely be derailed. Yeah. When you're going through at a younger age, you usually have a better support system of ways of learning around it, whether it's parents, coaches, teammates. It's generally a more positive atmosphere around it. But bottom line, you got to learn from it. And if you can't learn from your failures, you can't have growth. So, I mean, I think it is important to experience earlier in your career rather than later.
Yeah. I mean, failure in itself is the best thing you could look at. If you look at it like, oh, this happened, it's going to continue to happen. Well, why did it happen? What's your process to get out of it? If you can't see a light at the end of the tunnel, well, probably hang it up. So
what, if anything, were there coaches that helped you through that adversity, and how did they help you through that adversity?
Yeah, I mean, well, it just depends on if you're talking about pro. The best conversation I had was in college, and that was, and Nick Mingione, who is one of Daniel's favorite guys, mine and his favorite guys. Actually, he gave me a lot of crap through college, but I had one good conversation with him that to this day, the best thing that I ever had. And it was, you know, whenever you're going through things, sometimes you got to back off and quit worrying about yourself. And then you can push into your teammates to where you can become better that way. And it actually freed me up so much mentally to think of it that way. The game itself, like, you have teammates. I started talking with my friends more during games. I started having more fun playing the game. And then it became a game itself. And that's been the best part about my baseball career, is it's just been fun.
Yeah.
Ever since then, at least, because I pressed those first 2 years.
Finding the joy, finding the reason why you play the game.
Yeah, that's good. Can you kind of explain playoff baseball compared to regular season baseball? You had the opportunity to pitch in a couple playoff games, which is awesome.
Yeah, you show up to the park and people are already there and you can feel the atmosphere. There's games that you'll go through. There'll be a couple series every year that if you're in the big leagues, it feels like a playoff game. But dude, being especially at the Nationals Park in 19, whenever they ended up winning it all, it felt like every fan, I could hear them in my thoughts. You ever seen For the Love of the Game, Clear the Mechanism? That's impossible. But that is just an energy. You get all the way through the season, you fight, you do all this, all the routine stuff, keep yourself alive. And that October push, it's all adrenaline. That pushes you through. That's where I think that you see all these guys come alive, that, you know, you see who's really got the energy for it.
And I've heard some big league guys talk about, once you get that taste, it's just about getting back there, because it's like intoxicating. Like, it's so much that's the next level. And you can hear guys pretty much in every sport. You hear NBA players talk about it, you hear NFL players talk about it, but it just seems like everything you're doing is trying to prepare you for those moments, and then you finally get to go out there and just show it off. And some of those guys you were facing in the Nationals lineup, I know I talked to you just like, hey, what are some of the best series you played? You said Anthony Rendon, 19.
Yeah,
2019. And you said Juan Soto. And maybe you can talk about.
They were shrinking the zone. They weren't missing in the zone. And they were always out front of the fastball in every count. And whenever you try to jump something in, you better be sharp. And it just felt like they were up on top of it. Their barrels were getting through the zone really quick at that point. But they really shrunk the zone.
The crazy thing was, Soto was like 19, I think, or 20, maybe.
He's been doing the same thing his whole career, but that's what great players do.
We do like to kind of end things with like some fun stuff. The first thing, we just talked about Juan Soto. 15 years, $765 million.
What's he going to be, 40? That's, you know, that's a lot of money, but with all the rules and stuff they have out there, it may end up playing into his thing if they get the rule change or whatever, if that ends up happening.
What rule change are you talking about?
Where they were talking about having someone hit an extra time.
The golden at-bat rule.
Yeah, I don't like that, but that would end up making him of value. That's crazy.
We're going to do your starting lineup of your people that you played with along the way. We want 1 through 9 positions, and it doesn't have to be like, oh, this guy was the best or this guy was the worst or like whatever, but like kind of your favorite players of all time that you played with, 1 through 9. And like I said, they don't have to be like the best guys you played with, but guys you just were like
your favorite.
If you're going to roll out there and you're going to play a baseball game, these are the guys we want.
Okay. It can be college too. If you want to go college.
Yeah, we can go
fun team or what?
We're still trying to win a game.
Yeah, we're still trying to win.
I got to go nasty team then, because I got Yadi as my catcher. I got Goldschmidt at first. I got Colton Wong at second base. Renato's at third. I'm putting Tovar,
dude,
as my shortstop. He's,
I was texting you. I was like, I don't know if I've seen it.
Yeah,
like, well, he's so good.
He's just getting started.
Gold Glover in his second year, first year.
Yeah. For how young he is, he was so good this year. The at-bats he was taking, he was getting hits, he was doing damage, and he was playing awesome at shortstop.
My center field is really tough because I've had Harrison Bader, Brenton Doyle. I've had so many, but I got to go Brenton Doyle.
Gold Glover?
Yeah, Gold Glover.
I think dude. Former D2 guy, too.
In his rookie year, I think he's won the Gold Glove 2 years, and he's only been in the league for 2 years.
He's a grinder, and he's getting better is the thing. His swing is incredible, the progression. I think it's going to continue. I put Marcelo Ozuna in left just because I like the bat.
Yeah.
You're doing some damage there.
Yeah.
And then I'm putting Tommy Edman at right.
All right. So you're just to be clear, Albert Pujols is not on the team.
He's my DH. You said 9. I'm not.
That's fair. And then pitching staff. All right. Obviously, you guys spent a lot of time together, starters, right? So this is just all vibes, like guys you want to go out, grab a drink with. You don't have to like get them coffee and bring it back. This is like you get to go hang out. hang out with them, go golfing, that kind of stuff.
It's going to be me, Wayno, Miles Michaelis. I put Cal Quantrill on there. Okay. Hilarious guy. And John Gant. John Gant's my guy.
Awesome.
That's an all fun team on golf. If you're
all fun.
Yeah.
So the pitching staff,
plus the lineup's doing the damage. The starting rotation, as usual, we're the most fun on the team. Starting pitchers are going to have the most fun. Well, dude, an absolute pleasure talking to you today. Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for all the things that you've been able to impart on everybody listening, whether you're a coach, parent, definitely geared towards the athletes. I really hope some of you guys listening can take one or two things away from this. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for sharing your story again. Thank you, Will, behind the computer. It's been another great week here at the facility. We hope you guys tune in again next week
to hear about the horse.
Yeah, we will be talking about Premier buying a horse. And I'm going to end it with that because that should be enough to get you to listen to the next episode. So thanks again, guys. Like and subscribe. Backfield Banner out.